This online conversation is called Influencer Marketing, a Legitimate Communications Channel, with a question mark. Because as we've seen ways and ways again, is that in commercial sector, people use influencer marketing quite a lot and are embracing it. But it also comes with a lot of challenges. And challenges is something that we are really interested in. And at this session, we will look at the size of industry and speed of growth, define influencer marketing, and correct misconceptions. We will explore use cases of influencer marketing beyond selling stuff and importance of vetting influencers in the selection process. So now I would like to actually make a bit of a pause, because we have also published a new report which is looking at digital terms. We have a working group that is looking at NATO terminology and strategic communications terminology, and the biggest aim is actually to put together the understanding of different terms from our NATO perspective and putting it together with the academic perspective and perspective from other areas where people are working with these issues. It's available online already, and you can see a few examples of terms that we were looking at, and we really hope that you will find this research, this report, interesting and valuable. Okay, I would like to introduce you to Mr. Scott Guthrie. He's an independent influencer marketing consultant and a conference speaker. He is a top 10 PR blogger and media commentator. And he's also a co-chair of the Chartered Institute of Public Relations Influencer Marketing Panel, a Public Relations and Communications Association Council member, and an editorial board member of both Talking Influence and Influence Publications. Scott has written chapters for 5 business books on the subject of progressive public relations and influencer marketing, and his latest work, Virtual Influencers, More Human Than Human, is due for publication by Routledge in November. In the book, Influencer Marketing, Building Brand, Communities and Engagement, November is pretty soon, actually, Scott.
It's about 3 weeks away, I think, publication date. I'm very excited.
We are also very excited to have you here. And before we actually start this discussion, we did a small interview with Olga Kazak. She's working here in Riga, and she's working a lot with influencer marketing. And we did a small interview where she talks about what influencer marketing is and gives her take on that.
Influencer marketing is one of the digital marketing types, and influencers as themselves is one of opinion leader types. Influencers today is a very interesting phenomena, because we see it's not the same as celebrity, because celebrity usually are popular for the wise audience, but here we see that influencer can be popular for the very concrete small audience, but at the same time audience is very, very loyal to this influencer, and influencer can affect the purchase decisions of this audience, and that is why it is important, and that is why it is a very good marketing tool for the brands, for the organizations, and for, as well as for the political parties, etc. I would say that at the present moment in the field, we speak about the main challenges that face all the organizations that cooperate with influencers, and the main thing is to choose the correct influencer for your brand, for your idea. And first of all, can you with this influencer reach your audience in your region? The region is very important. For example, if I'm local product, local brand. Second thing, will I reach audience of the certain age, sex, values, and interests? And third thing that I would say is very important today is what we think about and we discuss about is an ethical aspect. Is it okay to advertise everything for money? Unproved magical tools for your health, or some magical water that can make you younger or live better, etc. And that is what we see is happening in discussions in the field of professionals of communication and influencers as well. that is also what is important, how we reflect this cooperation. Because what is important, usually when influencers recommend some products, audience see it as his or her choice that is made just because he like it. But we know from the field side that in many cases it is paid cooperation. So what we speak about at the present moment is that we need to speak more about these hashtags that say not only cooperation or collaboration that regular users not always understand, but to tag these posts as paid cooperation advertisement, and then it should work in a more ethical way.
So, Scott, I could see that you were nodding your head quite a few times, and I think we are ready to hear your take on influencer marketing and getting ready to ask many questions as well.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to speak today, and thank you very much for Stratcom for extending the invitation to me. I was nodding my head, but I was also making a few notes. I hadn't seen the video before, so I'm delighted and a little bit relieved that a lot of what I'm saying chimes in with that influencer who has just spoken in that video. What I was scrolling away furiously was that influencer marketing is not the same as celebrity endorsement, and that was represented in that video. How to choose the most appropriate influencer. It's about data and sort of about geolocation and about age. But it's also, I think, about the human side and the skill of the practitioner in choosing the most appropriate influencer for the brand or for the organization, and about the element of ethics as well. So I will cover that, and I'll cover it very, very briefly. You've already said, Linda, in your generous introduction, that I will be speaking about the size of influencer marketing, the speed of the growth, a definition, the different use cases beyond selling product, the importance of having a process in a workflow, but also a word or two on disclosure. I aim to talk for about 20 minutes, and I've been a bit ambitious in how much I'm going to try and cram into this presentation. But hopefully the Q&A afterwards, we can tease out elements of the bits that were of interest and the bits that we want to explore a little bit later. So in terms of that, where influencer marketing sits in the global ecosystem of advertising, worldwide advertising spend is around about $639 billion a year. And the largest subcategory within that umbrella is television advertising with $185 billion. Social media accounts for $102 billion a year spend. And within that, influencer marketing contributes around about $10 billion. So it's very small numbers if you think about influencer marketing against the Goliath of worldwide advertising spend. But the important thing is it's not necessarily today's numbers, but the direction of travel. And influencer marketing is enjoying a compound annual growth rate of between 40 and 50% year on year. So whilst it's around about $10 billion in 2020, it could be as much as $15 billion by the end of 2022. This slide here just shows you what I'm talking about in terms of the direction of travel. And if we look at television advertising spend globally, 34 cents in every dollar is on 34 cents on every advertising dollar is spent on television advertising. That was as true of 2017. By this year, by 2020, the 34 cents is dropped to 29 cents. And by 2024, it's thought that advertising on television will be around 26 cents in every dollar. Still significant, but it's sloping off. Social media advertising, on the other hand, is on the ascendancy. So whilst 3 years ago it equated to about a third of the spend of television, now it's about half the worth of television advertising at around 15 cents in every dollar. And by 2024, it will be about two thirds of the spend of television advertising. So you can see that there is, you know, in the next sort of 5, 6, 7 years, there might well be a crossover between social media advertising spend and television spend. we know, or I think we know, that influencer marketing, and as your influencer in the video said, influencer marketing is good at selling product. It's good at selling stuff. And if you look at the verticals on Instagram, the top three verticals for sponsored content are fashion and beauty and cosmetics. Those are the three top verticals. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but I'm very happy to share the slide deck after the presentation. If we look at the different age groups and different platforms, even the new kid on the block, TikTok, 40% of 16 to 24 year olds in Germany have said they have been influenced to buy something as a result of influencers on TikTok. And at the other end, the sort of granddaddy of social media platforms, YouTube, it's around, you know, it's 55% of Germans say they have been influenced to buy a product on YouTube. But I'm not here today to talk about selling stuff. I'm here today to tell you about why I think influencer marketing has become a legitimized communications channel. And largely, we've seen COVID-19 as this accelerator of change. And we've seen that in lots of different areas. But in influencer marketing, we've seen influencer marketing become more mainstream, more legitimate, and a wider variety of use cases. So way back in February and early March, we saw the United Nations, we saw the World Health Organization work with influencers and with influencer marketing agency to tap into parts of society that no longer regularly engage with mainstream media. And they carry those important messages about social distancing and about how to wash your hands thoroughly, and the dangers of touching your face too many times, for example. We also saw the Finnish government a few months ago reclassify social media influencers as key workers. And that was through their ability to tap into that audience who know the largely younger sections of society who no longer actively engage in traditional media. And in the UK, the Department of International Development, they launched an influencer marketing campaign to combat the myths about COVID-19, how it was spread. And that was specifically influencers in Southeast Asia and in Africa. So that was sort of at the beginning of the pandemic. But I wanted to bring sort of more closer to, in a mini case study. And this happened at the end, right at the end of August. I think it was like the 30th of August. So about 6 weeks ago. And the UK government started to work with influencers on its campaign to get more test and trace applications used in the UK. And we can see here, these are six random headlines from mainstream media and the mainstream media's reaction to the government working with influencers, in this case, working with Love Island stars. Love Island, for those that don't know, it's a global franchise of TV reality stars. So the mainstream media was pretty anti the government working with influencers. I take a more nuanced approach to this and think that they were absolutely right to tap into working with influencers. And here's a stat again from the last month from Takumi, a white paper. They surveyed 3,000 consumers in the UK, in Germany, and the United States. And they found that one in four consumers are more likely to source their news updates and opinions from influencers than from journalists or from established news outlets. So in this instance, it's absolutely right that the government should work with influencers. And they should work with influencers because, as I said, there's a large and growing section of society that no longer read newspapers, that no longer listen to the radio, that no longer watch free-to-air linear television. There's the same section of society that no longer has a blind trust in institutions, whether that is organized religion or maybe the government or big brands. So there is a nuanced trust, not a blind trust. Trust increasingly has to be earned. And we no longer like to be interrupted by advertisements. And we actively seek out bits of technology to block out those advertisements from coming in and interrupting our pleasure when we're on social media. So to return momentarily to the UK government and working with Love Island contestants, they worked with Chris Hughes. He's the guy on the left with 2.1 million Instagram followers, with Josh Denzel, who has 1.2 million Instagram followers, and Shauna Phillips with 1.5 million followers. So combined, they have an almost theoretical reach of 5 million followers on Instagram. As the influencer in your short video implied, selecting the most appropriate influencer isn't necessarily the most handsome or the most pretty or the influencer with the largest number of follower accounts. There is a workflow that should be followed to find the most appropriate influencer for your brand or for your organization. And here's a great case in point. Two of these images were taken in the weeks running up to the government working with those influencers on the test and trace. One of the images, the Shauna Phillips image, was taken a week after the collaboration on the test and trace. So here, if the PR practitioner had just spent a moment or two looking at the live grid of the sorts of content that these influencers were producing, they would know that, yes, they're the right fit in terms of reach. Yes, they're the right fit in terms of where their audience sits, mainly in the UK. Yes, they're the right group in terms of age group. But although this is about reaching people with the message on test and trace, another campaign run by the government at the same time is hands, face and space, i.e. the importance of properly washing your hands, the importance of using a face covering, and the importance of keeping 2 meters distance. And these three images show that none of these influencers are complying with by wearing face covering or keeping their distance. So this shows that when we're vetting, we should actively be looking at the creative style. And it also means that post-event, we should be having a set of words written down in a contract which says, for a limited amount of time, please abide by these guidelines. So I won't go through this in detail, but this is to show that I think when you're finding the most appropriate influencer, it's a marriage of science but also art. Yes, data will be able to help you with the audience match in terms of age and gender and geolocation. Yes, they'll be able to tell you the sufficient reach that they've got in terms of follower accounts. Yes, they'll be able to say what your average engagement rate is and whether it's likely that they bought fake followers or bought engagement. But it won't be able to tell you about their tone of voice. Data alone won't be able to tell you about their values and ethics. Data alone won't be able to tell you about their creative style, what they believe in, their brand sentiment, whether they are, you know, a COVID denier, for example. This means that you have to be have the contextual intelligence of the influencer marketing practitioner, as well as being able to use the tools to look at the data. Here's a very simple workflow process. And again, I won't spend much time on this, and it's similar to many other communication workflows. But this is just to emphasize the point that it's not just about finding someone with the biggest audience and getting them to read out a script. It's about understanding what your objectives are, understanding what your key performance indicators are, finding the most appropriate influencer through data and through human insight, co-creating the content and the agreement, the creative brief, producing the content which resonates with the audience, with the target audience, but also feels organic and natural to that audience, plus gets across the key messages from the brand or from the organization, and is compliant, as your as the video said about ethics and about disclosure. And then it's about measuring the KPIs, measuring intent rather than impact and impact metrics. So to sum up on this mini case study, was the UK government right to work with influencers? Absolutely, because there is a significant and growing section of society who no longer actively engage in mainstream legacy media. But you should know your audience, but you should know your objectives. The government said they were right to work with influencers because they managed to reach 7+ million people. But a better objective would be more than just reaching them, but what do they do after they've seen that bit of content? What have they done after that? A better objective might have been how many consumers downloaded the app. That would be a great intent metric. But the greatest impact metric would be how have the use of influencers flattened the curve and reduced the numbers of COVID-19 in the country. So we've talked about the importance of vetting. We've talked about the importance of a creative brief and contract. I think it's interesting to note here that none of the newspaper articles mentioned that this was part of an integrated campaign by the UK government. So yes, they were working with influencers, but they are also paying for radio advertisements, for television advertisements, and for newspaper advertisements. And a lot of the articles, the headlines, made play on the influencers being paid large sums of money. The fact of the matter is we don't know how much these influencers were paid because the government has as yet to announce those figures. A source close to Love Island influencers has told me that many went without pay, and those that did get paid were paid about half the amount. So there is increasingly, the point I'm making here is it's increasingly there's a disincentive for mainstream media to write positive stories about influencers because increasingly they're vying for the same advertising spend. A couple of words on disclosure. In the United Kingdom, advertising is governed by the self-regulatory body, the Advertising Standards Authority, and by the government watchdog, the Competition and Markets Authority. And in essence, ads must be obviously identifiable as an ad. And for an influencer, advertisement must be, to be obviously identifiable, it's got to be first noticed that it's going to be an ad, and then it's got to be understood that demarcation is that it's an ad. So we recognise it as advertisement. You have to be able to look at that bit of content without having to click on it or otherwise interact with it. And so here there is an example again from Shauna Phillips from the government and Love Island tie-in. You can see it's a nice bit of writing in her Instagram caption. It tells the story neatly. And then right at the very end, they've got a hashtag ad signifying the edited advertisement. So under current rules and guidelines, this wouldn't be sufficient to denote that this is a paid-for piece of advertising. It should have been number one right at the top before a throwback in the caption, so that we could have chosen to click on it or not we could have chosen to engage with that bit of content without clicking on it. When we think about disclosure, when we think about advertising, and we think about a commercial relationship, yes, that might be money changing hands between an organisation and an influencer, but it might also be gifts in kind. So if you are a hotel, for example, that might be a free spa treatment, or that might be access to the leisure centre, or it might be free drinks at the bar, or free meals, or a free hotel room. So in the realms of NATO, that might be a free or paid for press trip, for example. So you have to think, it's not just about money changing hands, it could be a gift in kind. And whilst in the UK, we're governed by the ASA and the CMA, in the US, it's the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, that governs influencer marketing. The ASA is part of a European alliance, the European Advertising Standards Alliance, and the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, is part of ISPEN, the International Consumer Protection and Enforcement Network, as is the FTC. And there are, I think, just over 90 other countries that belong to ISPEN. And they are banding together around the world to protect the consumer. So we've talked about influencer marketing being able to sell a product. We've talked about influencer marketing being able to carry important message around COVID-19. Here are some other, just to end up this presentation, a few other use cases for political, for influencer marketing. So we saw at the beginning of the year, Michael Bloomberg work with influencers in his short-lived campaign to be elected to the White House. Joe Biden continues to work with influencers with the same goal to get into to become the next president of the United States. It's not just political campaigning, but it's also influencers are also working to try and get more young people to vote and to register to vote. And here is David Dobrik, who's a Slovakian by nationality, living in the US, big YouTube and Instagrammer. This post, where he was giving away five Teslas, achieved 3.7 million likes. 3.7 million likes. Now, that is astonishing. And if you look at what he was trying to do, he was giving away five cars. And all you had to do to be in a chance to win that was to share the post on your account, to tag in a friend, and to see whether you're already registered to vote by clicking on headcount.org. And this one promotion managed to get an uptick of 120,000 voters to vote to be registered to vote for the US US election. And it's the single largest voting drive in the 16 years of that organization. It's a great achievement, phenomenal, but just bear in mind that it's 120,000 new voters registered, but it was 3.7 million likes. So again, when we're thinking about the KPIs, when we're thinking about how we can measure influencer marketing, we should look beyond vanity metrics, we should look towards intent metrics, and we should look towards impact metrics. So the intent is here is 120,000 have the intention of voting. Be interesting to see if we can track how many actually did vote. That would be the ultimate impact metric there. We've also seen that influencer marketing can be used in crisis communications. So we could say that the global pandemic is, of course, a crisis, and influencers are being used to help manage that crisis. But last year, Marcus Brownlee, technology YouTuber, he worked and created a piece of content about the Samsung ill-fated Galaxy Fold rollout. There were lots of, if you remember April of last year, there were lots of issues with the screen. And he created a video which addressed those points, said what Samsung was doing about it, and told consumers who had pre-ordered the phone what they could do to return handsets or to alleviate their risks. So here it's a different sort of crisis, but again, working with an influencer. Saudi Arabia has started working with influencers as part of its nation building strategy. And it wants to promote itself as open for business for young tourists as well. And to also say that their country has a lot of World Heritage sites. So again, it's the country building itself up and working with influencers as part of a nation building program. Lastly, penultimately, the winner of the PR Week Global Award this year is a piece of cause marketing and influencer marketing. And here, a German university hospital worked with an agency here, it was Ketchum, Germany, to promote young Germans to give blood. And so here again, it's not selling a product, but it's about saving lives and to see if they're the right fit for bone marrow. This is the last example here. Here's a case of back in 2017, and NATO working with influencers here. And NATO worked with this Romanian comedian with a large following on YouTube and a large following on Facebook. And he produced sort of irreverent content around the NATO maneuvers. So there was an exercise back in 2017, nine different countries, and there's the usual press trip, the usual serious newspapers and news agencies and broadcasters were there. But the Romanian was also invited, and that raised a few eyebrows because he wasn't producing serious newsworthy content. But what he did was he produced a subtle, a positive publicity designed to appeal to a younger audience. And here, one of the threads that's run right through this 20 minutes or so is that it's more than the size of the audience. It's about bringing the message to a new audience, a specific, relevant audience, an audience which, until watching this video, might not know what NATO is, nor what NATO's relevance was. And then finally, hopefully I've demonstrated through the slides what influencer marketing is, but it's a blend of art and science. It's about forming or changing opinions and behaviors, not necessarily about getting people to buy a product. And it's about partnering with people. It's not just about working with influencers and treating them like human billboards. It's about creating mutually beneficial partnerships. So I've rattled through it, and I've just noticed that the first time in the last 6 months, the sun has shone in the UK and might have cut me out. But that is my talk, Linda. Are there any questions?
Yes, actually, quite a few questions. But before I get to those, I thought that it's... At one point, you said that... that when we are looking at these ads, we have to realize it's advertising without actually having to click on it. But what happens when it is really not money being exchanged? It's a press store, or it's a gift. For example, in mass media, usually there are rules. For example, for journalists, there are limitations. You know, they can get a pen as a gift, but they can't get maybe a trip to Saudi Arabia as a gift with an expectation for them to write a nice story about Saudi Arabia. How does it work when there's no money exchange? Should there be written that it's advertising?
The quick answer is yes. And I think it's emblematic of influencer marketing being a young industry. I think that to protect the consumer, I think in the UK, this is talking from a UK perspective, I think that the ASA and the CMA, looking to protect the consumer, have been a little bit heavy-handed. So technically, yes, you said about a journalist being able to be given a pen, for example. There is no minimum limit in influencer marketing, technically. So, for example, if you did a campaign for Starbucks, you should declare that you got your venti latte for free. Even more, not worrying, but something of note, is that the CMA says that you should mention that relationship for a lengthy amount of time. And it says that that period of time should be 12 months. So I think you have to look on what is reasonable. But technically, to the letter of the guidelines, every time you posted yourself having a venti latte for the next 12 months, whether that was organic content or paid for content, you should flag it up that you were gifted a coffee 6 months ago or 9 months ago. So that is something that we need to work with the regulators to try and iron out. But technically, yes, you should be declaring it. And technically, the ASA did a big study last September, as in September in 2019, and said that the consumers really only understand hashtag ad. So hashtag spond doesn't really work. Hashtag SSP for sponsor doesn't really work. Hashtag gifted might not really work. It doesn't say it doesn't say you have to. It said that you strongly advise that you should use hashtag ad.
And I think, you know, we are currently, when we are thinking about influencer marketing, we are usually thinking about TikTok and Instagram. But I was when you showed the YouTube video, I actually remembered that there was quite a big conversation a few years ago when North Korea invited a few travel bloggers who have YouTube channels to visit North Korea, and they of course were very excited, and they had you know, they showed only the nice places in North Korea, so that was quite tricky as well.
Yes, and I think we've spoken today about how brands must properly vet influencers. Increasingly, influencers are vetting brands because they want to be influencers for a long time. They're realizing that this is their career. They realize that they are custodians of a community. And that organic community keeps those influencers in check. The community knows the influencer really taps in as the custodian of that community, taps into what the audience likes and what it doesn't care for. So if it makes a decision to work with a brand that might not sit well with that community, the community is going to call them out and ultimately vote with their feet. So that might be, I don't know, working with a gambling company, let's say, or a tobacco company, or an alcohol company. And you know, I'm old and I drink, and you know, I've smoked in the past. I'm not being sensitive about that. But some brands might not want to be associated with that. Some influencers might not want to be associated with that. And it's the same with different regimes and different countries. So you have to take a view on what you're comfortable with. And also, the number one desire, tracking above money for influencers, is to be able to having freedom in co-creating content, not being told, take a picture of this, write that. And so if you're taken to different countries and you're just showing the best bits, then it is something that a lot of influencers who want to be in it for the long run won't feel comfortable with, because they want to tell the whole story, not just what they've been told to tell.
And actually, you were saying that, I will quote you, you said that a brand has to find the most appropriate influencer. And I think one question that we have here from Anastasia Tolmachov kind of rhymes with this, because her question is, how do you find the best influencer, and does it have to be entertaining?
Does it have to be entertaining? That is a great question. And that scrolls back to what your objectives are. Because we turn to influencers for lots of different reasons. We turn to them for education or entertainment or inspiration or aspiration. It depends on what your brand stands for and what you're trying to, what you're trying to get your audience to do, what change you want them to have. So it doesn't have to be always, doesn't have to be entertaining as in humorous, but it does have to be able to be engaging content that resonates with that audience. And you're absolutely right. It doesn't, you know, it depends on, you know, where, who you are, as in who you're trying to affect a change with, and what age they are. So we saw on the early slide, you know, TikTok is very much for 16 to 24-year-olds, whereas YouTube is for 34 and upwards. And Facebook actually is in the 50s, you know, in terms of the sweet spot. So you have to know who your audience is, what you're trying to change, and where they live online.
There's another question. Well, there's a question about attempts to create an influencer artificially. Maybe here you can talk a bit about fake likes and fake followers, and how do you actually find out if these likes and followers are real or not?
Yeah, that's another great question. I'm slightly contrary in being anti-influencer fraud. An influencer fraud is when you buy a fake follower or buy fake engagement. Or you manipulate engagement by getting into a club with other influencers and say, you like my content and I like yours, and you write a bit of content and you write a comment and I write a comment. Being popular isn't the same as being influential. So that's why I'm saying, you know, why I'm sort of a bit gung-ho and contrarian about slightly being dismissive about influencer fraud, because we shouldn't be calculating success based on vanity metrics. We shouldn't be basing success on the theoretical reach of that piece of content, or how many likes, or how many comments are good. We should be looking towards intent metrics and impact metrics. So when we look at David Dobrik, huge success, got 120,000 new people to vote, huge thumbs up. But that came out of 3.7 million likes. So really, what is the value of a like? If that, you know, if it takes 3.7 million to get 120,000 people to sign up, it'd be interesting to see how many of those 120 actually went to go to the polls later and vote for the next US president. So, so there are lots of tools that you can use to find out who has been likely to have bought fake followers or bought engagement. Some of these tools are free. Some of them are freemium, so the entry level is free, and then you have to pay. There's a danger there that a lot of these tools are run by artificial intelligence and machine learning. And so the machine learning will rely on a small sample set and then extrapolate from that sample set. So if the sample set is wrong to begin with, then you're going to get more and more wrong. It's going to get more and more wrong as you get. So again, you need to use these tools, but also interrogate the figures with your human intellect. I'll give you a short example. There was one influencer that I know who was in Sydney, Australia, and he's a lifeguard. And overnight, his Instagram followers went up something like 10,000 overnight. So he would get found out as looking like he had bought those fake followers. It would be a big tick, and therefore a big flag on a lot of these tools that measure influencer fraud. However, he was part of, I think, Bondi Lifeguards that had just been picked up by Netflix in the US. And that aired on Sunday night, I think it was. And then all of a sudden, people liked him and followed him on Instagram. So again, you need to have the data. Absolutely, you need the science, but you also need the art to be able to have the skills of the practitioner to be able to check out that data.
Well, yes, and there can always be, for example, an information operation where you are buying likes and followers for someone else just to harm them. That can also be a possibility, or just buying a lot of comments to someone else, not to yourself, just to benefit yourself, but also to harm another.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, Linda? But yes, there are, luckily that they're few and far between, but there are plenty of existences where, you know, where, because it's an industry and you're all vying for the same the same gigs. If you work in a vertical, you're effectively as an influencer competing against other influencers to get that brand collaboration. And there are a few, yes, that have bought fake followers or bought fake engagement and bought them with the username of a competitor influencer. You're right. But that's why I'm a bit gung-ho about it. That it shouldn't matter so much, because we should be moving away from vanity metrics to more something more substantive.
What I'm always thinking when I'm thinking about influencers is that, like, are they promoting your brand or your product or your service, or they are mostly promoting themselves? So it's really hard, actually, and especially when we speak about numbers, it's really hard to tell this. Well, I was just wondering if these Love Islanders at the end of the day were really happy or unhappy about being included in this campaign, because probably, you know, from one point standpoint, when a government asks you to spread the message, then they are kind of legitimizing you as a valuable voice within the community. But then from the second point of view, you get a lot of backlash as well. And I was thinking that maybe for government agencies or influencers working with government agencies, it's just a safer bet to not take any money and just to say that, you know, we're just doing it because we want to support our government or an organization.
I think that's very valid. And I think that, and I'm not suggesting this is true for Chris Smith and Josh Denzel and Shana Phillips, but there are a lot of celebrity Love Islanders that realize they've got at most 18 months of notoriety, and they will sell anything to anyone because they realize that their fame will slide after a year, certainly after 18 months. I'm not suggesting that that's the case with these three people. But yes, yeah, you are motivated. Well, you have different motivations to undertake a piece of work. And that's why increasingly, as I was saying, you know, brands vet influencers, but increasingly influencers are vetting brands. Are they the right fit for me as I grow my own brand? And are they the right fit for me and my community? I think that's a big question. And were these Love Islanders the most appropriate as well? There are lots of other influencers that might have been used. There are lots of, for example, doctors and nurses by far the NHS who would be a more credible figurehead for the government to promote the test and trace. And they might not have the colossal numbers, but they have the authenticity and the trust, and then you could amplify that message with some paid spend behind it. So again, we shouldn't, you know, back to that slide with the workflow, it's not just about finding the person with the largest follower count or the largest or the prettiest face, for example. It's finding the most appropriate for what you want them to do.
And there is a very interesting question about countermeasures. So the question goes like this. With QAnon being an influencer with a very negative tone of voice as example, how would you counter the negative influencer influence?
Again, these questions are really apt, they're really opportune. There's a slide I shared where one in four consumers say they turn to an influencer before they turn to a media outlet. An influencer before, a journalist or a media outlet. And that reduces to one in three if you're below the age of 44. So that is both good and bad. Just because a brand isn't working or an organization isn't working with an influencer or isn't talking to an influencer, that doesn't mean that the influencer is not talking about you. And I think that's a really important message. You can be dismissive of it, but that doesn't mean they're not talking about you. And one of these other slides was about vetting. It's about the brand sentiment. Have they talked about you when you're going to work on a brand collaboration? Has that influencer mentioned you in the past? You haven't done a paid for relationship, but have they mentioned you in the past? And if so, was it favorable, neutral, or negative? Because influence is a neutral term, and we sometimes conflate influence and advocacy. An influence is someone who can change an opinion or a behavior. An advocate is a supporter of something. And so you're absolutely right with the QAnon. You need to be able to identify who these people are, identify what they're saying, and do your best to neutralize what they're saying if it's negative. Or put out, and if you can't neutralize them, at least put out more positive stories about why they are wrong. But just to ignore them is no longer going to work.
And another interesting question that we have here is how do you measure, especially if it's not just selling stuff? How do you measure if it's, for example, a campaign about COVID-19?
Well, here again, we were saying that the government in this, going back to the Love Islanders, the government said that they were pleased they worked with these Love Islanders because they reached 7 million people. That they wouldn't have reached it through radio and television and newspapers alone. Now that measurement is that's a theoretical reach. That is just adding up the number of followers and combining them in aggregate. That doesn't give you the true reach. That doesn't tell you how many people actually clicked on that bit of content. So how do you what do you measure? It depends on what your objectives are. So here they were measuring on reach. They might have also measured on vanity metrics like numbers of likes or number of comments. But I think in this example, and the question was about specifically about COVID-19, an intent metric might have well been how many people actually stopped and downloaded that application, or how many people clicked on a link to find out, to download, to go to a microsite and find out more about how to wash your hands and how to wear a face mask and how to, you know, how to test. Or, and ultimately, you know, is it working by, are we flattening the curve of new COVID cases? So it's not just about reach here, it's about what happens after that, that the consumer has engaged with the content. And that, you know, nothing to do with COVID-19, but a few years ago, The Body Shop worked with influencers to carry a message about ending testing testing cosmetics on animals. And that wasn't just about, and they teamed up with celebrities and influencers, but their message wasn't just about how many likes they got or how many views they got. It was about how they could affect change. And they set they set themselves with the goal of getting 8 million signatures on a petition within a year, and they got 8.3 million signatures on a petition in 10 months. So that wasn't just, you know, that was signing a petition and then taking that petition to the United Nations. So it depends on what your objectives are to what you're going to measure. But with The Body Shop, it was about getting people to sign a petition and then doing something with that petition. They took it to the United Nations and then put pressure on individual legislators to change legislation. So different metrics at different parts of that communication program.
Yes, I actually think that you were mentioning microsites. I think they are not used enough, because it really can concentrate all your kind of efforts to measure either it's clicks or people signing up for something, etc. So, of course, much more brands are now looking into selling either their ideas or brands or products through influencer marketing, and we can start noticing that many of influencers are just as a question comes here, says that they're becoming buyouts and thus losing credibility, because that sometimes there is a feeling that, you know, when you open Instagram stories, it's just basically like going to a shop where someone is selling many things, and then you can notice also that many influencers are selling the same thing because there's clearly a campaign going on. So what happens to their credibility? Because especially in post-COVID era, people are moving even faster from TV ads and newspaper ads into social media advertising. Influencer marketing is on the rise. But if there's a feeling that it's just only advertising, will they lose credibility in the next years?
I think as consumers, we enjoy influencer-generated content, but on three provisos. And one is that we don't feel hoodwinked into thinking that a piece of organic content is, a piece of paid-for content is organic content. And that's why it's the importance of disclosure, importance of putting hashtag ads or whatever it is. We don't want to feel manipulated to think that a piece of paid work is a piece of editorial work. Secondly, that bit of content has got to provide some value for us. And we had an earlier question, does it have to be entertaining? It doesn't have to be entertaining, but it has to provide us with some value. It has to be aspirational or inspirational or educational, has to provide us with some value. And the third thing, to answer your question, is there has to be a nice ratio of paid for to organic content. And it's probably 1 in 4 bits of content should be paid in a stream. That might be more, that might be fewer. But really, we don't want to see ad after ad after ad after ad in a stream. We want to see a nice mix. And also, we're moving from a spread of influencers working with a stack of brands on one-time deals to influencers working with a few brands, but really creating long-term relationships. So it's going from a horizontal to a vertical. And that produces, I think, more interesting content, because the brand and the influencer get to know each other. So it gets, you get to shorten the turnaround time and the content creation, but they get to trust each other a bit more as well. And so the brand can think of ideas that they might not have been able to trust with an actor or an influencer on the first iteration. After a number of iterations, they get to say, well, you might want to, you know, see our factory, or you might want to see what is in development, or you might want to whatever we're going to do next year. So there's development of trust. And a lot of influencer marketing is front-loaded in terms of finding the most appropriate influencer. That takes time and that takes costs, both in terms of using third-party tools and in terms of getting lawyers involved in agreements and all of that, you know, and just the time of the practitioner. So it makes absolute sense to be able to work with influencers again and again and again and create longer term relationships. That was a long answer. I hope that was, hopefully it was helpful.
Well, I think that's as much questions as we could take in this 1 hour. And what I'm going personally to take away from this conversation is that we have to find the right influencer, and we have to know our audience. We have to be open, transparent, and we have to brief and educate influencers about what we are trying to achieve and what are our values. And I really hope that at the end of the day, all those who want to work with influencer marketing will be able to find these things. Is there anything you would like to add as a last takeaway?
No, I think the couple of things that I want to add to is, yeah, it's more than selling a product. We can use it in lots of different ways. And it's importance of measuring beyond vanity metrics, and each campaign, every communications goal and every organizational goal will be different, but setting it up at the beginning so you can measure at the end. And the third takeaway is to always make sure that you draw the blinds so you don't get a lot of shadow in the middle of my talk. So I apologize again for that.
Thank you, Scott. And thank you for being here and asking your questions and leaving your comments. I would want to remind you that we had a conversation about influencer marketing with Scott Guthrie. And I would also at the end want to tell big thank you to Olga Kazak, who is a professor and a partner at Olsen & Partneri, who gave the first interview that you heard at the introduction of this event. And big thank you to the team who helped to put this all together. See you next week. Thank you.